Welcome to the CodeCast Podcast. Real-world insights for your daily medical coding and billing processes. And now, here's your host, Terry Fletcher.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CodeCast Podcast today. My name is Terry Fletcher. Happy Tuesday morning, or whenever you download your podcast to listen to it. I had a really good week and funny feedback from last week's professionalism podcast. It really helps that all of you seem to have my same sense of humor. I had one listener DM me and say that she came back from lunch with a box of Altoids on her desk, and she thinks she needs to thank me for that. And I was like, you know, I hope that's okay. But you know what? Trust me, someone had your back on that. So it's all good. It's all positive. And I just love when people send me direct messages and let me know that some of the information I give you or some of the things just to set up your desk. Somebody sent me a really good or great photo of the little mason jars or dollar store little jars, and they had all their stuff in it. So she's like, I listened to you and I did what you said. And I was like, this is cute. So I really like that. Now, today's topic, we're going to just talk about something that comes up, I would think, a lot in your practice, especially if you're primary care or internal medicine or even cardio or GI or a medicine specialty. And I want to talk about clarifying preventative services, medicine services, over E&M services, which are problem-oriented. I'm doing so much auditing this month and this year, and I see many physicians saying in their chief complaint something like, patient here to establish care. And then they're trying to bill a level 99205 or 99215 if the patient is established to the practice. And sometimes, rarely do they say something in the chief complaint that shows the patient actually complaining or three chronic conditions. And so it's just rare that it really does qualify as a level 5 service. But we want to look at this from an AMA, CPT, and Medicare perspective before you report one or both services incorrectly. And yes, it is possible that there's a time when you can bill for both the preventative and the E&M service, but you need to be aware of the share of cost implications for your patients. So they may have copay on both services. Also, I got a really good coding question this week. It's actually more of a management question that has to do with coders. And it's not a short answer. And also, my personal tidbit will be something that I deal with daily and hope you'll be able to relate to it as well. And there's some information on there that may go a little bit longer. So like last week, I might go over my 30-minute threshold today, but hopefully you'll find it interesting and relatable, and it'll be part of your healthcare work environment that you'll be like, oh, I've been actually wanting to know about that. So let's go ahead and get started. And this topic that comes up for preventative services versus evaluation and management codes, there's always some difficulty in navigating this scenario because things tend to unravel and everybody has a different opinion about it. And so I want to clarify when an evaluation and management E&M code can be billed with a physical or what we call a preventative service on the same day. But there are a couple of things to keep in mind if you're going to consider it. So CPT guidelines for preventative medicine says if an abnormality is encountered or a pre-existing problem is addressed in the process of performing this preventative medicine eval, an E&M service, this evaluation or E&M service, and if the problem abnormality is, and this is pretty important in the discussion, is significant enough to require additional work to perform the key components of a problem-oriented E&M service, then you can also report it. But what I'm seeing is that typically it's not significant enough. And the guidelines continue, and sometimes people stop reading after that, the first part, but it continues to say a significant or an insignificant or trivial problem or abnormality that is encountered in the process of performing the preventative medicine evaluation and management service, which does not require additional work and the performance of key components of the problem-oriented E&M, should not be reported. So what does this mean kind of in lay-term language? Well, the modifier 25 guidance must also be followed because you're going to need it on one of your services, typically the E&M code in this scenario, because the primary reason the patient came in was for their yearly physical or their physical exam or their preventative care. Medicare and other payers don't expect that a patient, especially an older patient, wouldn't have chronic conditions. And if those conditions are stable and don't need significant work to address them, then that work of just talking about it and listing it is bundled into the work for the preventative medicine codes 99381 to 99397. Refilling medications, ordering labs for stable chronic conditions are included in the preventative service per the guidelines. And that's not considered significant additional work. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the interpretation by the physician. So for example, let's say a 34-year-old established patient comes into the practice and they come in for her yearly physical. And during the visit, the physician learns that the patient has gained an abnormal amount of weight since her last appointment. So the physician discusses healthier eating habits, exercise program with the patient, and with the patient being slightly overweight with a BMI of, let's say, 24, decides to watch the patient's weight, and that is documented in the chart. Well, in this situation, the preventative visit includes reviewing the patient's weight, any kind of what they call anticipatory guidance and risk factor reduction. So all of the work performed would be included in the preventative medicine code, and you would not be able to bill an additional E&M service. It would not be supported. And so in that scenario, it would be 99395, 18 to 39 years, and the description there is periodic comprehensive preventative medicine reeval and management of an individual, including an age and gender appropriate history and exam, counseling, anticipatory guidance, risk factor reduction interventions, and ordering any labs or diagnostic procedures. And so your primary diagnosis even would be Z00.00, encounter for a general adult medical exam without normal findings. Then you can add the R63.5 for abnormal weight gain or E66.3 for overweight. And then a body mass index is always helpful too in the Z68.26 or higher or lower codes. Now, if the patient came in with that scenario and did have an acute problem or an exacerbation of a condition that does require additional work and work up by the physician or provider that they wouldn't normally perform in the course of an exam, then an E&M code can be billed in addition to the preventative visit, but the patient will have probably two copays as well, and you can't write one off. So let's say the same situation happened and the patient also had a really bad rash on her right arm, and it was starting to have open wounds, and there was going to have to be a prescription for that and some issues there. And also the patient was allergic to certain things, so they had to navigate around that. That could possibly be a level 3 service depending on the documentation as far as a 99213 for that patient. So in order to code under that scenario, all of the elements performed as part of the physical are counted towards the preventative medicine visit code only, and only those elements that constitute the significant additional work can be counted toward the E&M level. That's why I try to get physicians, whenever this scenario comes up where there is a split bill, two separate encounters. One is for the preventative service and one is for the separate evaluation of the E&M service. So the key is to know when additional workup is significant enough to warrant a separate code. And you must have an illness that requires its own separate evaluation with, again, the E&M elements or history and physical exam and medical decision making all related to that separate problem. And so when that happens, then you best definitely have a better opportunity if you have to appeal it. But the problem that I run into from an auditing perspective is when preventative medicine services, or well checks is what people like to call them as well, when somebody comes in and they say established care. And so here's where we have a problem. And this is a lot of times Medicare age patients. And I mentioned before that, you know, a lot of Medicare does expect that Medicare age patients are going to have some issues or some chronic conditions. And so preventative medicine services still have to include a comprehensive history and exam, but it's called age appropriate anticipatory guidance. So it's not the 95 or 97 guidelines. Basically, the exam has to reflect an appropriate assessment given the patient's age and gender. So, for example, the specifics of the exam will differ from a 4-year-old male versus a 22-year-old female. So let's look at a child, for example, on a preventative. Services for a young child will assess physical growth, height, weight, head circumference, and developmental milestones such as speech, crawling, sleeping habits. Also, they give some anticipatory guidance. Then this includes use of car seats, safety issues, maybe introducing new foods or allergies to the patient or the child. An adolescent preventative service also may include scoliosis screening, assessment of growth and development, maybe review of immunizations, and then anticipatory guidance may focus on developing positive health habits, self-care, including discussion of drug, alcohol, and tobacco use, and possible sexual activity early. A comprehensive preventative visit for an adult female almost always includes a gynecological examination, so a pap and a breast exam. An adult male's exam would include an examination of the scrotum, the testes, and the prostate for older patients. And then anticipatory guidance may focus on issues of health maintenance, such as alcohol and tobacco use, safe sex practices, nutrition, and exercise. And the patient's employment status and other family issues could be discussed as well. They may even talk about, as the patient advances, cholesterol levels, blood sugars, prostate-specific antigens, that's the PSA testing, and that may become increasingly relevant. But you see, even though those may be considered conditions to some, they're part of a preventative service. So diagnoses will be preventative in nature as well. You're going to be in the Z code section in the ICD-10 book, which are factors influencing health status and contact with health services. So you would start maybe at Z00.110 or Z00.00, and what I gave before. So these all based on the age of the patient with or without normal or abnormal findings. And then tests and problem focus tests are separate. So if an abnormality is encountered or pre-existing problem is addressed in the process of your visit, then when you look at that, so in the process of performing the preventative service and management service, and if the problem or abnormality, and again, I'm going to say, is significant enough to require an additional workup to perform the key components of a problem-oriented E&M, then you may be able to code the newer established patient with a modifier 25 as well. But remember, you have to determine whether the problem requires significant work and consider whether the available documentation is sufficient enough. Because saying that they're going to run labs because they suspect that you could be pre-diabetic, that is still going to be part of a preventative service. If the patient now is complaining of polyuria, polydipsia, and the patient also is an obese patient, plus they've also had other issues as well, and they also have another chronic condition, then you may be able to warrant that as a sick appointment or a problem-oriented visit. But it's tough because a lot of these things are monitored through the preventative services. And coverages may vary as well, so make sure you know what your coverage is. When the Affordable Care Act came out, and that's also a version of Obamacare, it required insurers to cover recommended preventative services without any patient cost sharing, but exact coverages and reporting requirements definitely vary from payer to payer. So there's still going to be some kind of cost sharing as well. And then based upon that information, it is not to be appropriate to specifically report certain exams. So let's say that the patient came in for their pap and pelvic and the breast exam. You would not also report a separate pelvic exam because you have to have that, let's say, in a preventative female service. And so that's just something you want to really kind of embrace and understand. Otherwise, you're going to be billing the wrong thing. When I talk to or review some of my cardiology records on audit, I'll see them always say establishing care, but there's nothing going on with the patient. Everything's stable. Everything looks good. They're just coming in to establish care, answer some questions. And if you don't have my chronic conditions, or you don't have, and I say my because I'm the one that's auditing, or you don't have my chief complaints where there's a problem today, and basically they're just going from one doctor to another to help manage these services, that's preventative. And remember, Medicare may not cover that. They just cover, they allow it, but then the patient has to pick up the different out-of-pocket. So that's where you have to know the difference between establishing care versus a sick appointment or a problem-oriented service. So we're going to talk about our coding question today. And this one is interesting because, okay, so I have two. The first one is an ICD-10 coding question. And it said the patient enters the hospital with a STEMI, which is an acute MI that's emergent, involving the left anterior descending artery. And 3 days ago, he had a non-STEMI MI? Is this subsequent STEMI because it's within 4 weeks, or is it, you know, an I-22.0? What is the second diagnosis? So, and then she also went on to say, or since this was 3 days ago, is this just a STEMI MI? So it is what it is at the encounter. And so if the first encounter with the patient 3 days ago basically was classified as what we call a non-STEMI. What a non-STEMI acute myocardial infarction is they also call it acute coronary syndrome. It means that the patient has possibilities that they had a heart attack, but they don't know within the encounter if that's really what it was. So they're making some assumptions. It means that they probably had high troponin levels. Their white cell count was high. They had some severe chest pain and shortness of breath, but that doesn't mean they had a heart attack because it wasn't confirmed. So I would not factor that into this encounter. I would code what it is in this encounter, and what it was is I-21.02, which is an ST elevation, so a STEMI myocardial infarction involving the left anterior descending coronary artery. So always remember that. Don't read too much into it. Read to what it is. Now, if 3 days ago they had a STEMI and now they had another one, then yes, that would be the second service, but then that would be subsequent, I should say. But because they didn't have a classified heart attack before, you're just going to bill it as now this one is the classified heart attack. So my next question, actually it comes from a few listeners, so I'm going to combine what they've said. And I get this question a lot in some form, and I wanted to explain this because I think a lot of practices take the simplistic route or actually don't calculate it at all. And that's where you can run into some staff burnout and some real issues from mental health in your office if you're not paying close attention to this. So the question comes in and it said, Terry, I had a question from about a doctor to coder ratio. We have 25 general surgeons, 6 PAs, 5 nurse practitioners, 2 pain management doctors, and 3 vascular surgeons. There's only 5 coders and 2 billers in my practice. My question is, what is the optimum ratio for coder to doctor? Right now we have roughly 5 to 7 doctors assigned to 1 coder. Okay, so let's just talk about this, and it's going to take me a second. So this is a very difficult benchmark to discuss because a practice size has a lot to do with what you're going to need. A good ratio in a large practice is very different from one in smaller practices, and understandably so, because larger practices not only achieve some economies of scale, but also tend to carve out employee responsibilities a little bit different. So a large practice might have specified coders and specified billers, if you will, and maybe even a designated Medicare specialist, but a smaller practice might rely on a single person to do it all in conjunction with their other duties. So this ratio is still important, but it's going to be on a different scale. Let me explain. So in many practices, it's viewed strictly as an expense indicator. However, I really feel strongly that it's also a significant overall gauge of your practice's financial health. That's because the lower your billing staff to provider ratio, the more consistent your revenue cycle tends to be. A high billing staff to provider ratio potentially points to underlying revenue cycle problems, including too many rejections, denials, and appeals. These are all the time and labor-intensive activities that could increase the need for billing staff and then raise the ratio. Automated tools can be helpful to address some of these problems as well, and that can be solid. But before you calculate your practice's staff to provider ratio, it's essential to know how to do it correctly. And I know some of you think, well, it's simple enough. You just count up the doctors in your practice and divide by the number of billing staff, right? Well, not so fast. So rather than count each physician individually, a common mistake, practices must make sure to count physician full-time equivalents, so FTEs, to properly calculate the number of physician full-time equivalents with your practice. Divide the total number of patient encounters performed during the past year for your entire practice by the average number of yearly physician encounters. So this number will be between 3,600 to 4,800 depending on your specialty. Primary care tends to be higher at the end of about 4,800 and single surgery specialists, and orthopedics tend to be around 3,500 to 3,600. But the reason that you want to perform FTE calculation in this manner is to accurately account for physicians who work part-time or job share, or basically they just don't hold a less than full-time schedule. So to calculate the number of billing staff, FTEs, you want to define an FTE as an employee who has been compensated for 2,080 hours of work. So that's 40 hours a week times 52 weeks a year with a 2 weeks paid vacation. Like the physician FTE calculation, this will take into account any employees that work less than 40 hours a week or not full-time. Hours to include in this calculation should be related to any personnel that participate in the physician revenue cycle, including data entry, coding, payment posting, accounts receivable follow-up, patient statement processing, etc. Okay, so here's a simple calculation. I know some of you that are listening to this in your car, you're like, oh my gosh, he's killing me here. But just think about this. And you know what? I'll blog on this and I'll put it on my website. That way you can actually print it off and say, okay, let's see if we can do a calculation. So billing staff employee, number one, was compensated for 2,080 works of work, 1.0, full-time employee, so full-time employee there. So basically, we're going to be dealing with 2,080, that's one full-time employee. Billing staff employee two is compensated for 1,720 hours of work, so that's a 0.83 FTE. And then billing staff employee number three was compensated for 15 hours of work, and we're saying per year, and that's a 0.72 FTE for that billing staff. Okay, so let's take a couple of physicians. Dr. Nguyen performed 1,800 encounters, which equals 0.5 FTE physician, 1,800 to 3,600. Dr. Williams performed 3,600 encounters, so 1.0 FTE physician. And the billing staff FTE count equals 2.55, so 1.0 plus 0.83 plus 0.72. The physician FTE count equals 1.5 FTE, 1.0 plus 0.5, and the billing physician to billing staff ratio of 1.70, and that's basically your 2.55 divided by your 1.5. The MGMA put this in their book, and if you see it, it's called Benchmarking Success, the Essential Guide for Group Practices. They provide a standard ratio of 2.7 billing staff per physician in an average billing office. So they look at this calculation broken down, but that number also does not take into account the particulars of a practice size or any other factors that might alter it, but it's a good starting point for your own investigation. Also, if you have remote coders, you want to take some of that information as well. So no matter what your ratio is, I really urge you to view it as a barometer for your revenue cycle. Consider whether you have an opportunity to arrive at a better ratio by automating some of your practices, but this will kind of give you at least a calculation you can show your physicians, and really go to MGMA to try to get that book to see if that can be helpful for you. Because I'm sure just listening to me talk about it is a little bit tough because you're not really sure kind of where to go with that, but it definitely can give you some insight as far as how to make your calculations. And what I'll do again is I will definitely put this on my website as a blog, and I'll do it this week so that you can take a look at it, and we'll have it up to you by Thursday. My podcast producer doesn't like putting up a blog on the same day as the podcast because he says it confuses people, so we'll try to get it up a couple days later. The coding question is brought to you today by Stranger Things, netflix.com/Stranger Things, and Anesthesia LLC. ABC offers seamless physician billing and practice management software and services to thousands of anesthesiologists and CRNAs nationwide. AnesthesiaLLC.com. Okay, so this week, I want to say hello to a couple people, and then I'm going to get into a little bit of a health talk just on my personal tidbit. But Leanna in Montana, thank you for your kind email on Facebook post, and Jade for her really nice email. That was such a sweet thing to say. But my Facebook has really been picking up on the Terry Fletcher Consulting. So Belinda and Greta and Marla Ray, thank you. Vicky in Orlando, thank you for all of your great Facebook comments. I really appreciate it to all of you that just take the time to visit my sites, my social media, all of it. So I really appreciate that. So my personal tidbit this week is about self-care, okay? And I did this because I'm going to challenge you to think about this just as much as I need to challenge myself. But I've talked about good mental health and making sure that you take some time just to breathe for yourself. But we need to talk about sleep, and we need to talk about it because I'm tired today. I went to Comic-Con this weekend. And that's where the Star Trek people are and all the comic book fanatics are. Boy, there's some really interesting people out there. But it was really fun. But I didn't get home till very late. And then on Saturday night, and almost you consider it early if it was around after midnight. And then I had to get up early on Sunday. So I was feeling very foggy. And I've always been able to function well on pretty much 6 hours a night. And that's kind of what my body likes. But anything less just makes me nauseous throughout the day, and no amount of coffee is going to help that. But I found that lack of sleep is now really contributing to some more health issues and than any other neglect on self-care that you may give your body, even more than drinking, even more than doing anything. So I try to read a new article every day on healthcare, whether it be medical economics, WebMD, Journal of American Medical Association. So what I found of lack of sleep, I just wanted you to hear it from me. And I'm sure you've heard different things from different sites and everything. But because I really want to try to do my best to try to up my sleep pattern to 7 hours, you know, 8 would be a luxury. I actually have a friend of mine or a colleague. He said he gets 9 hours every night. I actually don't even know why we're friends. Who has that kind of time? But the brutal reality is he's probably pretty happy and always feels rested. But this is where you have to really like understand what's happening if you don't get some sleep. So let's just talk about it for a second. And I found this not just on WebMD, but I have a sleep study physician that I work closely with, and her and I were really having a good conversation about this. So we know that lack of sleep can make you grumpy and foggy. I'm the first person. I get very irritable. But what you may not know is it can affect your sex life, your memory, your health, your looks, even your ability to lose weight. So here's some serious issues and effects of sleep loss. And guess what? It's a top 10 list. Of course it is. Sleeplessness can cause accidents. And that's the number one. And I started with number one instead of going backwards, because I don't know if you remember, and this might, some of you may age yourself here with this, but in 1979, there was a nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. And the massive, remember the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and then the nuclear meltdown at Chernobyl in 1986. Well, these were contributing factors was lack of sleep for people who were basically in charge of public safety. And sleep loss is very big on public safety, especially if you're on the road, and drowsiness can slow reaction time, just like if you were driving drunk. The National Highway Safety Administration says that fatigue is the cause in almost 100,000 auto crashes and 1,500 deaths every year in the U.S. And it's mostly a problem, and the greatest problem, for people who are under 30. And so studies do show that sleep loss and poor quality sleep leads to accidents and injuries on the job. So we really have to, and more sick days per accident. So we really have to be careful with that. Also, and this is where we have to be careful in the healthcare field, sleep loss, what they call, dumbs you down. It plays a critical role in thinking and learning. Lack of sleep hurts these cognitive processes in many ways. First, it impairs attention, alertness, concentration, reasoning, and problem solving. And it's really hard to learn if you're tired. And then during the night, sleep cycles play a role in consolidating memories in the mind. If you don't get enough sleep, then you won't be able to remember what you learned and experienced during the day. Sleep deprivation can also lead to serious health problems. And I know you've heard of all this, but it does put you at risk for heart disease, heart attack, heart failure, irregular heartbeat. High blood pressure is a huge one, stroke and diabetes, just to name a few. And so 90% of people, it's been estimated that with that have insomnia, also have another health condition. And then lack of sleep kills your sex drive, but that's for my other podcast. So you get depleted energy, sleepiness, and increased tension, and can be largely to blame for it. It also can be for men with sleep apnea, a respiratory problem that interrupts sleep can also be a factor in some sexual issues. So I'm talking about it in clinical terms. So just make sure that you are aware of some of those issues when it comes to making sure that you're getting your sleep, because I know that's a real big one. And then number five is sleepiness is depressing. Over time, lack of sleep and sleep disorders can contribute to symptoms of depression. So when you're dealing with this, there was a sleep poll in America, and people diagnosed with depression or anxiety were more likely to sleep less than 6 hours. See, I have my magic 6 hours sleep there. And the most common sleep disorder, insomnia, that was the strongest link in 2007 was its strongest link to insomnia and depression. And so people were 4-5 times more likely to develop depression for those without. And so insomnia is also the first sign of depression. So when you're looking at that, sleep ages your skin, as if we needed something else to help with that. Remember, gravity is not helpful, especially to women. But most people have experienced the sallow skin and puffy eyes after a few nights of missed sleep. It's like telling somebody, you look rough. Well, this is what's happening. You know, your skin ages, you have dark circles under your eyes, and you're just not looking good. So when you don't get enough sleep, your body releases more of the stress hormone, cortisol. And in excess amounts, cortisol breaks down skin collagen, the protein that helps keep skin smooth and elastic. Sleep loss also causes the body to release too little of the human growth hormone. So as we age, it helps increase muscle mass, you know, thicken skin and strengthen bones. And during deep sleep, if you don't have that release, that's going to be a problem. It can just be, it'll kind of tear things down for you. Sleepiness can also make you forgetful. Trying to keep your memory sharp, get plenty of sleep. So brain events they did at the American and French researchers conference, they called sharp wave ripples are responsible for consolidating memory. And they also, these ripples also transferred learned information to the neocortex of the brain where long-term memories are stored. And they found that there was a direct occurrence between these ripples and the lack of the deepest level of sleep. And so we don't want to lose our ripples. We're going to get forgetful. Now we know it also contributes to weight gain. Because if you snooze, this talks about here when it comes to body weight, it may be if you snooze, you lose. Lack of sleep seems to be related to increased hunger and appetite and possibly to obesity. And I would say it's more likely to obesity than possibly, because a lot of people say basically to keep themselves awake, they feel like they need to eat so that they can, just stay awake. And sometimes that shortened sleep time is associated with increased levels of appetite. Also, not only does loss of sleep appear to stimulate the appetite, it also stimulates cravings of high fat, high carbohydrate foods. And so that's why at night when you're sitting there going, oh my gosh, right now I just want this, that's what that does. And lack of sleep, believe it or not, British researchers say it can increase the risk of death. So they said that they did a study of 10,000 British civil servants over 2 decades, and it was published in 2007, and it showed that those who had cut their sleep from 7 to 5 hours or fewer per night doubled their risk of death from all causes. That's kind of frightening. And most of it was cardiovascular disease. And then the last one, sleep loss impairs judgment, especially about sleep. So lack of sleep can affect our interpretation of events. And this hurts our ability to make sound judgments because we may not assess situations accurately and act on them wisely. And so sleep-deprived people tend to be more prone to poor judgment when it comes to assessing what lack of sleep is doing to them. And we have a fast-paced world right now. And so a lot of people don't sleep because they think they're going to miss something. But, you know, you really need to, if you think you're doing fine on less sleep, trust me, I know I'm not. I need to really work on upping my sleep to at least 7 hours. And if you work in a profession where it's important to be able to judge your level of functioning, that can be a big problem. So make sure, because your body adapts to anything. And studies have shown that people who are getting 6 hours of sleep instead of 7 or 8, they begin to feel that they've adapted like to that sleep deprivation and got used to it. And so you want to always keep yourself mentally alert, keep your performance up, otherwise it can go downhill pretty quickly and you can lose touch where you are. So I really hope you take that as a sign that, you know, I just want you to be really good with your self-care and just think about getting a little bit more sleep, even if you just add 20 minutes to your schedule. And typically it's not being able to get up 20 minutes later, it's going to bed 20 minutes earlier. So I'm going to try with an hour and see if I can actually do that, just shut everything off. So let me know how you do with that. Hopefully that gave you some insight this week and you found that our topics this week were very relatable to your healthcare work environment. So on that note, everyone, make it a great day and a great week. And until next time, thank you for listening to the CodeCast podcast.
For more information on medical coding, billing, auditing, and compliance, including how to hire Terry, follow Terry on Twitter at TerryCoder1 or visit her website at www.terryfletcher.net. Podcast producer Joe Kuzma. music producer, Dasassin Music.